Good morning. I do have my notes, Carrie, so we're good. Well, we'll see anyway, right? I'll never forget the day that Bella broke. Now, Bella was our first Honda Civic, because back in the day before Aubrey and I had children who each have countless stuffed animals with their own unique names and long backstories, back in the day we used to name our cars, and Bella was our Honda Civic that was sleek and silver. We thought she was beautiful. But that beauty that she had was not enough to keep her going. And there was a day I was driving home, and all of a sudden, she couldn't go any faster than 10 miles an hour. Now, being the astute, mechanically-minded person I am, I immediately knew something is up with this car that can't go faster than 10 miles an hour. So when I got home, I made plans to see a mechanic. Now, imagine you had been there with me that day in Ohio when my car was dying. And imagine that we took Bella to three different mechanics together. We might learn pretty quickly that not all mechanics are equal. For example, imagine we drive up to this dilapidated old shack and a man shuffles out dripping in grease saying, "I know, let's just pour oil in everywhere under the hood." We might be kind of skeptical. So let's say we move on to another place, a white futuristic-looking building with gadgets everywhere, and a man runs out with frizzy white hair and big goggles and a big white lab coat and says, "I know the problem, it's the flux capacitor." We might again be skeptical. And the third shop has it's a humble-looking place, and a man walks out wiping his hands on a shop rag. His name is Joel, and he says, "I think it's a transmission, but let's investigate to be sure." Three different mechanics. Each can perceive a problem with my car, but only one seems to have the knowledge, diligence, and concern to actually solve my problem. And if I want to fix my car, I have to know how to discern a good mechanic from a poor one. Now, that is in micro, the idea of discerning good from bad mechanics. In micro, what we need to do today in a nation that is sometimes quite literally on fire. 2020 has been widely regarded as the year that not a car, but our nation broke. Left, right, Christian, atheist, many from polar opposite views today can agree on at least one thing. There is something wrong with the world. Something appears to be broken. Now that we might emphasize different problems, some focus more on the violent protests, others focus on the storming of the Capitol building in January, but we all can generally agree, in spite of our other differences, there's a problem. Something is wrong with the world. But here's where we disagree. What is the problem? What's wrong with the world, and how do we fix it? From university classrooms to social media feeds, from podcasts to pulpits, there is one diagnosis of what is wrong with the world that has been rapidly gaining popularity. You probably hear about it in the news or on your social media feeds. It goes by the shorthand, social justice. And it has found favor within Christian circles, largely because it borrows from Christian terminology. But in this case, the devil truly is in the details. Because not all pursuits of justice truly are just. Some, in fact, are counterfeit. And this morning we're going to look at social justice, the worldview, and three reasons why we ought to be concerned about what we are seeing culturally. And that is, the first, social justice gets truth wrong. Second, it gets the problem wrong. And third, it gets the solution wrong. Now, you might be thinking, why this morning? Why spend so much time on this? Well, earlier this year, Wendell said, "Hey, Seth, how about talking about vaccines when you come this year?" And I said, "No, let's not deal with controversy. Let's take something totally uncontroversial, like social justice. That should go well." But there is a deeper reason, I think, why we should spend time on this morning. And I think the Bible compels us to do so. The Old Testament is full of passages of God accusing his people of faithlessness. They don't follow through with the covenant he made with them. They don't make good on the promises they made to him, even though he always makes good on his. And one of those well-known passages of God accusing his people of faithlessness is Micah 6. In Micah 6, in the middle of this, God accusing Israel of faithlessness, you get this beautiful summary statement of God's expectations for his people. We read this: "He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God." Now you see here in Micah 6:8 that doing justice is not a suggestion for God's people. It's a basic expectation of all of us who follow him. So we must engage with the social justice worldview, because these people who believe in this say they're doing justice, and we're commanded to do justice. So we have no option of disengaging. We must engage with the dialogue. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, there's another important principle in Scripture. And that we can see in Jeremiah 7, another passage of God calling his people to reform their ways. In the middle of God telling his people, you must reform your ways, we see this from God where he calls his people not to just, where God makes a promise to them to bless them again if they reform their ways. He makes his promise conditional to them. We read this, "For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice one with another, then I will let you dwell in this place." So God commands his people to truly execute justice. But why that word truly? Why would that be there? Systematic theology professor Thaddeus Williams, he unpacks this passage this way. He says that presupposes there are untrue ways to execute justice, ways of trying to make the world a better place that aren't in sync with reality and end up unleashing more havoc in the universe. Now, Williams writes this in his new book released just last Christmas called Confronting Injustice Without Compromising Truth, 12 questions Christians ought to ask about social justice. And if you're interested in this topic at all, I heartily commend to you his book. But so from Micah 6 and Jeremiah 7, we get two key ideas here so far. First, we must not check out on issues of justice. We're commanded to engage, to do justice. But secondly, we must ensure that our response is truly executing justice, that it is not one of those untrue ways to try to execute it. And my contention this morning is that the social justice worldview is one of those untrue ways. Now, I'm assuming something. I'm assuming that when I say social justice, you're tracking with me, because I assume we've all been watching the news over the past several years. We've seen, we're on social media feeds. But just to be clear, we're all on the same page. When I say social justice, I am not referring to a generic category of seeking justice in society. That is not my reference point. I'm talking about a worldview, the mainstream dominant thought we see in our culture today, which dictates positions on most, if not all, hot-button issues of our day. This is, for example, the worldview that calls it justice to criminalize therapy for people who want help with same-sex attraction. This is the worldview calling it justice to give naturally born men access to girls' sports teams and locker rooms. That calls it justice to require taxpayers to fund elective abortions. That calls it justice to have violent responses to perceived racism. Now, some, like Professor Williams, use social justice B for this worldview to clarify that there is a social justice perspective that is compatible with Scripture, namely social justice A. But just to be simplistic this morning, I'm using biblical justice and social justice to make it kind of easier to follow along. But when I say social justice, please don't misunderstand me. I am not speaking about the long-standing Orthodox Christian vision of justice in society. I'm speaking about a worldview dominant in our nation today and creeping into the church. So, also one other side note. We must remember when we talk about worldviews, we're talking about the ideas in theory, but people who hold worldviews don't always hold them consistently. So not everyone who says they pursue social justice may see things exactly as we're discussing this morning. We're talking about the general ideas that are at play. So, social justice. What's the problem? Well, first of all, social justice gets truth wrong. Now, let's go back to my broken down car, Bella, and the three mechanics. What is the difference between a good mechanic and a bad mechanic? The good mechanic acts not only on a theory of what he thinks is wrong with the car, but also based on evidence of what is actually wrong with the car. Because the good mechanic understands truth. And truth is telling it like it is, when what you say or think matches the way things actually are. They match up with the real world. So Joel, the good mechanic, he might guess, I think it's the transmission. But then he gets his hands dirty, digging into the car to find out if there's good reason to believe his idea of what is wrong with the car matches the reality of what truly is wrong with the car. He wants to know, I have a theory. Is there good objective evidence to support my theory? That's a good mechanic who understands truth when what he thinks matches the way things actually are. This idea of truth is why doctors do diagnosis before prescription. They don't just throw medicine at someone. That'd be a really terrible doctor. First, they diagnose and look at what is really wrong. Now, maybe they can't confirm with 100% certainty the patient's concern, but they want to know, is there a good reason to believe this is really the issue the patient is facing before prescribing medication? Now, truth seekers are not immune to assuming that what they think is true actually is true, right? We all are prone to assuming that, but we should be open to evidence. And if we find evidence that what we think is true is not really true, We course correct. I mean, think about Paul on that road to Damascus. Walking down that road, he had a worldview, an idea in his mind. He thought was true. In Paul's worldview, Jesus was a false Messiah. The Christian church was evil and had to be eradicated. But then he encountered incontrovertible evidence that what he thought was true did not match up with the real world, because he encountered literally in the flesh Jesus Christ after he'd been killed. So his idea that Christ was a false Messiah was wrong, and Paul had to realign his worldview to match the way things really are. That's pursuing truth. But now all this presupposes a couple of things. It presupposes, namely, that there's a real world, this pulpit, the beautiful bricks that Wendell laid in here, in this church building, that all of that is a part of the real world. Not fantasy, not just images projected on your mind that you're in your mind's plugged into a matrix computer somewhere. This all is real. It also presupposes we can interact and engage and know things about that real world. We can access it and know things about it. That's how Joel the mechanic can say, I think it's a transmission, and then interact with the car to find out if that truly is the case. The biblical idea of truth presupposes there is a real world, and we can all access it and know things about it. Consider the abortion debate. When we say the embryo is human, we're not saying, believe us, just take our word for it. We're saying, we've looked at the evidence, we've concluded that, yes, the embryo is a human being, but what do you think? You can interact with the same real world, read the same scientific evidence about that world, and find out, is our idea true or not? That is the biblical view of truth. This, however, could not be more sharply contrasted with the new social justice view of truth. In this worldview, truth is not something all can discover. Instead, there is secret knowledge only accessible to some. I was recently talking to a friend of Aubrey's and mine. We'll call her Sarah. Sarah's an ardent believer in social justice, and she disagrees with Aubrey and I on every major cultural issue of the day, in spite of claiming to be a Christian. Not surprisingly, on abortion, she's told me that my view as a man holds less weight than hers. And I asked her why, and here's what she said. You don't have the life experience to make an informed choice. You can have an opinion, but you also have the privilege of walking away from pregnancy, and that might make the choices involved seem easier than they really are. Now, take note of what's going on here. Sarah does not reject the real world. She appeals to the way things really are for people in the world. What she rejects is my ability to properly perceive that reality. As a man, my membership in a certain class, being male, makes that knowledge inaccessible to me. Those who are part of another class, that is the class of women, a class that Sarah sees as oppressed, they have access to knowledge that I, as a part of the other group, could never, ever discover. Now, this wasn't an isolated conversation. I've given Sarah an abundance of objective evidence over years for my view, but she sees it always as lesser by default because than the opinion of a woman, not because a woman's evidence may be better than mine, but because her membership in a certain class, the class of women, a class that Sarah sees as oppressed, makes their opinion true and mine not. Now, Sarah's demonstrating the social justice view of truth here. There may be some truths that we can all discover. Mathematics, for example, we can all follow that. But there are on other topics, topics of justice, topics of injustice, racism, sexism, and so on. Here, there is truth that is secret knowledge only accessible to those who belong to the class deemed oppressed. And there are many examples of this. In 2018, remember the Kavanaugh hearings? Before Ms. Ford, who was going to share her story against Justice Kavanaugh, before she said a word in the hearings, major media outlets were talking about her truth. No one was saying his truth, but her story was labeled truth by default from the beginning because of her membership, because of her alleged membership in a class that is oppressed, women who've been assaulted. But this is not moral relativism of everyone has their own truth and they're all equal. Remember, no one was talking about his truth in relation to Kavanaugh. Social justice privileges the lived experience of those considered the oppressed, those who belong to certain classes, whether they be women, people from ethnic minorities, or so on. Their experience is not one truth among many. Instead, it is universal truth all must accept as true. This is perhaps no more evident today than in discussions of racism. Now that we all know this. The Christian worldview has no place for racism. It is an abhorrent sin. But not all who oppose racism do so from the same worldview. In 2019, Tyler Say, an anti-racist social justice activist at Williams College in Massachusetts, was fed up with what he considered to be racist attacks against certain professors at his school. So he issued a charge to his university. He said this: stop with the discussion groups, workshops, committees. Accept the grievances of faculty of color without question. Now, Say was not requesting a fair hearing from people belonging to the class of those considered oppressed. He demanded their assertions, if they belong to that class, be it considered true by default. And he is far from alone. That very same year, Evergreen State College professor Nay Malow took the next step, asserting that to ask questions of those deemed oppressed about their experience is itself oppression. She said this: to ask students who are suffering from white supremacy to tell us about the instances of white supremacy is itself racism. We must stop asking them because we're inflicting harm. To ask for evidence of racism is racism with a capital R. So when there are charges of racism from the class deemed oppressed, don't ask for evidence. Assume the opinions based on lived experience from those in these groups are true by default. So the difference between biblical justice and social justice does not seem to be on whether truth exists, but rather it's a dispute of who can know truth. On the biblical worldview, all contest truth claims to find out what is true. According to the social justice worldview, when it comes to certain topics, topics of injustice, racism, sexism, so on, only those who belong to the class considered oppressed, they're the only ones who can know what really is true. And so we must accept their views as absolute truth. Now, two side notes before we move on. First, if you're interested in this discussion of truth and social justice today, I commend to you the work of Drs. Neil Shenvey and Pat Sawyer. This is an ebook published by Rosho Christie, a Christian apologetics group. They have shown that if you are interested in this, when you trace the ideas of social justice, you often come back to what they have found, which is that it's tied to critical theory. And critical theory is a philosophy that, among many things, asserts that those who belong to oppressor groups, like white people, cannot perceive truth. They're blinded by privilege. But those who belong to the oppressed classes, they have special access to truth that must not be challenged. And second, anyone here who loves church history, I know this church is a lot of people, you might have some bells ringing in your mind, and that is because this social justice is a new Gnosticism, following in the steps of that heresy the church faced many years ago. Shenvey and Sawyer write this: one of the most brutal struggles the early church faced was against Gnosticism, a movement which insisted that certain spiritual truths could only be obtained through secret knowledge available to select individuals. Today, it's certain topics, injustice, only certain individuals, those in these classes, can access truth. They continue, contra Gnosticism, the church insisted Christian theology had to be founded on public revelation God had supplied to the church from its inception. Public revelation. That means accessible to all, open to testing by all. Think of Paul's list in 1 Corinthians. We all know this list. 1 Corinthians, where Paul gives a list of those who saw the resurrected Christ. Chapter 15, verse 6, he says that important point that over 500 saw Christ alive at one time. And then he has that super important statement that many of the witnesses who saw him are still alive as I'm writing this. That means he's inviting people to test his claim. He's saying, this is what I know. Test the claim for yourself. Interview the witnesses. Find out if my claim is true. That is the Christian view of truth. Open to testing by all can discover it. We're facing today a new Gnosticism. Who can know truth? Is it accessible to all? The question that we have to face is also, are we up to the challenge of fighting this new Gnosticism? So first, social justice gets truth wrong, saying it's only accessible to some, can only be known by some. But secondly, because it gets truth wrong, it also gets the problem wrong. Remember Rusty? He's that mechanic who wants to pour oil in every hole he can find under the hood of my car. Imagine Rusty never did diagnostics at all. Any car that rolled up to his dilapidated shack, he took one look at it and said, I know the problem, and just acted on it. And once in a while, he might get lucky, right, and find the problem. More often than not, though, Rusty's going to be wrong because he fails to test his theory and just acts on what he thinks is actually the problem. And that's what happens with social justice claims about what is wrong with the world. Let's consider today one of the most sensitive topics in our nation, and that is fatal police shootings. One of the reasons there's so much energy behind this topic today is because when you look at the data, you see some pretty clear disparities. In 2020, according to the Washington Post, there were about 1,000 people who were fatally shot by law enforcement that year, 2020. Roughly 50% were white, roughly 25% were black. Now, here's a clear disparity. People who are black make up about 13% of our U.S. population, 13% of the population, 25% of fatal police shootings. When you look at the numbers, we should all recognize that's a pretty clear disparity. We can all recognize the difference in the numbers. We can all make theories of why this is the case. But the social justice worldview assumes a conclusion. This disparity must be the result of racism. Racism that is systemic, that is spread throughout the system of law enforcement. Consider the leading anti-racist thinker and professor, Ibram Kendi. He has said very clearly, as an anti-racist, when I see racial disparities, I see racism. No testing, no evaluation of what caused the disparity, but instead immediate conclusion that this proves systemic racism. That's what caused the disparity. And Kendi, I'm not just cherry-picking from him. He underscores this is his view in his call for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which would declare outcomes between racial groups, if they're different, that is unconstitutional. He's not calling for an investigation into what causes differences in outcome among various communities, but says those differences, those disparities, are unconstitutional by default. Now, Kendi may be a leading voice, but he's far from a lone voice crying out in some wilderness somewhere. Protests across our nation, we've all seen, have been predicated on the assumption the police force is systemically racist. The assumption that racial disparities in outcomes for different classes, that even showed up, you might remember, it showed up last summer in my prematurely ended debate here in Fort Wayne. My opponent referenced differences in outcome among groups based on color. She said the differences they experience prove systemic racism. She appealed to, for example, the differences in maternal mortality among women who are white and black, saying that difference proves systemic racism. Now, biblical justice demands we neither assume nor reject any theory out of hand. So we should neither assume systemic racism is always the problem, nor prematurely reject the theory. Like a good mechanic, we should roll up our sleeves and do the hard work of testing the theory, asking whether there is good reason to believe it's actually true. But that's exactly where we meet the problem. Recall the social justice worldview idea of who can know truth. To ask, is there reason to believe that racism was a motivator of this or that killing, is to miss the point. Because the lived experience of the oppressed class must be assumed true by default, no questions asked. If they feel it was racism or sexism or any other ism, that is true by default, no questions. And worse, if you ask questions, recall that's not merely futile, it's worse than that. Remember the Evergreen State professor who said that asking for evidence of racism is racism with a capital R. So when someone who is black is shot by police, to ask whether there's evidence racism was a factor is not only off course, we're told it perpetuates the injustice itself. As a side note, I'm a bit skeptical of the believe the oppressed mantra, not only because it perverts truth, but because it seems very unequally applied. There are many great intellectuals who are black who happen to question the social justice narrative, great thinkers like Thomas Sowell, Shelby Steele, John McWhorter, who are excluded from the dialogue. Why are their views not accepted as truth by default? They belong to the same class, deemed oppressed. So people who are black who are skeptical are excluded. And interestingly, white people who agree with social justice are included. If you've talked with anyone today about racism, you've undoubtedly heard a few terms: whiteness, white privilege, white fragility. These did not come from the community you might expect. They were all crafted and popularized by liberal white women, Judith Katz, Peggy McIntosh, and Robin DiAngelo. Add to this the Columbia University sociologist Musa Al-Gharbi, his findings that relatively well-off, highly educated liberal whites tend to be among the most zealous in identifying and prosecuting new forms of racism. You start to see a bit of a trend that liberal whites are invited to speak, conservative blacks are disinvited. The trend does not prove social justice wrong, of course. At best, though, it points to a bit of hypocrisy that is concerning, and at worst, it suggests that the whole believe the oppressed mantra could be a smokescreen for something else, like maybe believe my leftist ideologies. But regardless, when you get truth wrong, you usually get the problem wrong, too, because you resist testing your theory. Undoubtedly, racism has been involved in many horrific acts in our nation. But if we assume that is the problem in every situation, we're going to falsely diagnose the problem sometimes, and that leads us to bigger problems. Because the casualty of social justice is not merely thinking in ideas, abstract things, like who can know truth. When you get truth wrong, you get the problem wrong. When you get the problem wrong, you get the solution wrong. And that brings a real human toll. Imagine that Joel the good mechanic sees Rusty pouring oil everywhere under my hood. If he runs up and says, hey, Rusty, hold it for a minute. Let's test that theory of yours before pouring oil in everywhere. If Joel does that, he's not showing disregard for my car. He's actually showing he cares more for my car and me because he wants to stop Rusty from applying the wrong solution to a misperceived problem, causing more chaos in my car. Joel, by saying, slow down, let's test this theory, shows he has greater concern for my car and me. And that is why Williams, Professor Williams, after using the mechanic illustration I've been using all morning in his book, he concludes this. Contrary to popular opinion, questioning whether and to what extent sexism, racism, or any other anti-biblical ism is the real problem is siding with the oppressed. To question whether my car actually needs more oil is in favor of the car. And similarly, questioning whether any issue, such as shootings, gaps in salaries between men and women, is actually a result of racism, sexism, or so on, is working in favor of the group we want to help. To see why that's the case, let's continue with our discussion of today's lightning rod issue, and that is systemic racism. But let's consider another country first, where maybe we all have a little less invested. The United Kingdom. This spring, the UK Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities released a long-awaited report evaluating the widely accepted theory of systemic racism, racism spread throughout the system of the UK. Now, their finding was they couldn't find evidence of systemic racism. That was not to say there was no racism at all, but the theory that the systemic racism caused these differences in outcome for various communities, they could not find evidence of that. What they found was these differences seem more evidentially tied to other factors, like differences in schooling, childhood trauma, poverty, and things like that. Now, you don't have to accept their conclusion this morning. Some have challenged the report, and we should be open to all sides and read all discussions. But I have a much more modest goal this morning with citing the UK Commission. When we refuse to consider other possible theories of what is wrong, we hurt people. Mercy Meraki is a journalist and member of the Commission on the UK, and after they released the report, she went onto a podcast unpacking some of the big takeaways of the report regarding racism and systemic racism in the UK. Here was her takeaway. She said, we have to have these conversations about why it is that these disparities, differences among various communities take place. And yes, it involves making awkward and uncomfortable hypotheses relating to family and culture, and no one wants to go there. Now here, Meraki's referring to things like fatherlessness, the breakdown of the family. People, she say, don't want to go there. Because Meraki went on in the podcast to say, once you say this disparity is a result of systemic racism, you assume you've found the root of the problem. And that means you look for no other roots. Because once you find the root, you dig it out and you're done. You don't look for other problems. But if there are other problems, you're not going to find them. You're not going to resolve them. The conversation stops, Meraki said, once you assume it's systemic racism. So let's come back to our nation and the sensitive matter of fatal police shootings. There is, again, a clear disparity. People who are black make up 13% of our population, 25% of those fatally shot by the police. There are probably racists on the police force, right? Just like there are racists in many vocations today. But to jump from here to the conclusion that every fatal shooting is the result of racism may not be a leap supported by evidence, but not only that, it might worse prevent us from having a full analysis of these events and really important conversations on really uncomfortable topics that could really help. Peter Kirsinaw is a a prominent attorney, a black man, a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And in the commission's 2018 report on police use of force, Kersenal writes this: "The data make clear that blacks are overrepresented among victims of police shootings." So Kersenal is not an eye-closed conspiracy theorist saying, no, those numbers are false, fake, no, believe them, there's no difference. He's not thinking that way. He concedes the point, yes, clear disparities among the communities. But he goes on to write, "But they're underrepresented relative to their overrepresentation in crime, particularly violent crime." And Kersenal summarizes with a very uncomfortable line: "Black neighborhoods," he writes, "have higher crime rates." Now, Kersenal has put his finger on a critical conversation our society should be having. The more violent the crime, the more violent the response will be from law enforcement. And as Kersenal tragically notes, the rates of violent crime are not consistent across communities. Now, this must not be an excuse for racist generalizations about people based on the color of their skin. But if anyone genuinely cares for our brothers and sisters in these communities, we must ask, why are black neighborhoods typified of higher crime? Why are people from the black community overrepresented in rates of violent crime? These are not quick, easy questions with glib responses, but the point is that if we assume it's systemic racism, we don't even get to ask these questions because it's assumed we already know the conclusion, and to even question that conclusion, we are told, is to perpetuate injustice. This could have dramatic implications for the communities we want to help. When anti-racists call for abolishing the police, who's going to benefit? Not the youth growing up in these neighborhoods typified of higher crime. And as the narrative of systemic racism in law enforcement advances, many officers may withdraw from these neighborhoods because who would want to be party to a fatal shooting that could make you public enemy number one, regardless of the facts, regardless of the context? And if the police withdraw from these neighborhoods, neighborhoods where there's a high percentage of people who are black, leaving people increasingly on their own, we have to ask, are we helping the black community? Biblical justice demands better. Years ago, there was a popular book among Christian circles titled When Helping Hurts: How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Yourself. And the central idea was that if we have faulty assumptions about the causes of poverty, we end up with strategies to combat it which only make things worse for people who are poor. A biblical response to poverty demands better. And today I submit to you that the biblical worldview, similarly, demands better in responses to concerns faced by many groups, whether they be women, people from ethnic minorities, and so on. If we have a faulty assumption of the causes of differences in outcome between, for example, black and white communities or men and women, if we have a poor theory of who can know truth, we're going to end up with strategies that will probably do more harm than good. We have to be like the good mechanic whose concern for his clients, his genuine concern for them, causes him to test his theory and find the best solution. We have to roll up our sleeves, be open-minded to evidence, and respond to injustice in a way consistent with biblical truth and which avoids helping in ways that might actually hurt. In other words, biblical justice, in contrast with the social justice worldview, demands we be discerning for the sake of truth, and for the sake of those truly in need. Indeed, we must truly execute justice. To aim towards some goal that is not just is not biblical justice. It's a bad worldview, which will only end in more chaos in our world. And today, that's playing out in our streets on every social media feed. But social justice is not only bringing chaos to our streets, it also poses no small risk to the evangelical church. Many leading evangelical voices, once considered bulwarks of sound theology, are, in my opinion, borrowing from this worldview. I've seen this in pastors and writers for whom I once had great respect. They begin by joining popular calls to justice, but slowly borrow from the social justice definitions of those words. And soon you see some of them interpreting the word of God through a social justice lens, for example, allowing for two interpretations based on whether you're an oppressor or an oppressed person. In other words, rejecting the orthodox understanding that there is one objective meaning to each text. I've seen this in friends. They hear calls for justice and join the parade, but they didn't realize there's an alternate worldview animating that parade. It's the one that does not play well with biblical Christianity, and over time they slowly adopt a new worldview. That's a problem. And that's why this morning we've spent time evaluating social justice, the worldview, today. We found, again, three reasons why we ought to be concerned. It gets truth wrong, it gets the problem wrong, and then it gets the solution wrong. In the Christian worldview, all contest truth claims and discover what is truly true. But in the social justice worldview, when it comes to some topics, racism, sexism, so on, you can only know what is true if you belong to a class considered oppressed. And because social justice gets truth wrong, it usually gets the problem wrong, too. Leaders of this view reject open testing of their theories, and so it's impossible to confirm or deny them. And the result is seizing on solutions, so-called solutions, which may not only miss the mark, but might even worse, hurt the people we want to help. So what do we do? I think a simple starting point is ask some good questions. When someone calls for justice, which is daily these days, ask this. Ask, does this statement, does this argument reflect a proper understanding of truth? Or does it suggest that truth is only something certain people can have access to? Is this theory of what is wrong with the world open to testing and evaluation, or efforts to question it shut down? And are there good reasons to assume the solution would respond to the actual problem? In other words, is this truly executing truth? But in closing today, I don't want to be misunderstood. By critiquing a worldview called social justice, I am in no way suggesting Christians should exit stage left when it comes to social matters. I mean, you know, Aubrey and I, that we've dedicated much of our lives to fighting a terrible injustice. But it is because we care so much about justice, truth, and our neighbors that we feel compelled to speak to this issue. So in closing, I want to encourage you, do justice. It is still entirely possible today to, even with widespread cultural confusion, to cut through it all with a clear message and fight for true justice. And I think we have actually a very distinct opportunity. Earlier we cited Micah 6, right? The well-known passage, God's expectations for his people. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly. Have you noticed today that many seize on doing justice and forget or reject entirely that whole loving kindness and walking in humility? That gives us a true opportunity. Years ago, there was a British newspaper that was said to have asked a question of its readers, what's wrong with the world? They asked the readers, what's wrong with the world? Give us your list. Tell us what's wrong with the world. And readers wrote in with long lists, just like you might see on Twitter today. Someone saying the problem with the world is people wearing masks or people not wearing masks, or it's looting or it's shootings, whatever, so on and so forth. Long, long list. People wrote in with these. But one person, Christian thinker G.K. Chesterton, responded to this question with two simple words. In response to what's wrong with the world, he said, anyone know? I knew many would hear. I am. Chesterton's elegant response gets to the heart of biblical justice. Recognizing the problem is not just out there somewhere, it's in here, in our hearts. Because we are a fallen people. Our most fundamental problem is not abortion, racism, disputed responses to COVID-19, or anything else you might list. These are real problems for which we need real solutions. But they're all symptoms of a deeper problem, a problem, as Chesterton knew, none of us are immune to. It touches all, regardless of sex, race, age, and that problem is sin. Some movements, I think today, have forgotten or rejected this outright. Instead of humility bred from acknowledgement of their own sin, their celebration of pride and of arrogance, and instead of kindness to those who disagree with them, there is rejection, exclusion, seeming hatred. We have an opportunity to be different and love kindness and walk in humility. And if you're confused by the noise surrounding debates of justice today, start by asking, who's loving kindness today? Who evidences humility? And that's not a guarantee of who is right, but where you find these qualities, you're probably more likely to find true justice as well. For humility and kindness do not come easily to those leading a culture war, but it is fitting for those who remember that apart from God's grace, we would be the slave owner, we would be the abortionist, we would be the sex trafficker. What sets us apart is not our virtue, it's God's rescue. So what's wrong with the world? Fallen humans are. But what's right with the world? God is. We must remember who we are, remember who he is, and then we are far less likely to fall for counterfeit worldviews, and we will also have much greater hope of truly executing justice.